1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 237, Patriarchs and Politics from the ERA to the Proclamation on the Family, with panelists Lori Winder-Stromberg, Martha Sontag-Bradley, Nadine Hansen, and Marilyn Wierenski.
We'd like to get started. Patriarchs and Politics from the Equal Rights Amendment to the Proclamation on the Family. This session takes its title in part from Marilyn Wierenski's groundbreaking book published nearly 20 years ago, Patriarchs and Politics, The Plight of the Mormon Woman. Wierenski gave voice to the fundamental incompatibility of feminism and patriarchy before many of us were willing or even able to address publicly the subordination of women in the LDS Church. While the writing of her book was not initially prompted by the Church's then-emerging political campaign against the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment and the International Women's Year meetings, Wierenski was not surprised, and I quote, that the growing resistance of the Mormon patriarchy to the women's movement ultimately became a matter of public concern. This now over two decades-old resistance was punctuated last year when President Hinckley introduced The Family, a proclamation to the world, at the annual women's meeting in September. The proclamation reaffirms the traditional role of presider, provider for men, and nurturer for women, and that gender is eternal, and implies that gender is eternal rather than culturally constructed. Considering our struggle to confront these issues, Wierenski's comments near the end of her book remain particularly timely. The current show of power of the Mormon patriarchy in enforcing its extremely conservative and rigid position regarding women is thought by many to be the most divisive issue within the Mormon Church in this century. The LDS Church's political involvement over the last 20 years has focused increasingly on issues of gender. In order to justify its political actions on these issues, church leaders have deemed them moral rather than merely political concerns. However, the line between the two is at best obscure, and the tactics employed by the church to further its agenda occasionally have been legally and ethically questionable. With the publication of the proclamation on the family, we see emerging some of the same political tactics employed by the churches, by the church during the ERA era to combat same-sex marriage. This panel will examine, interpret, and evaluate the church's political activities with regard to issues of gender, from its opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment to its current concerns as articulated in The Family, a Proclamation to the World. Martha Sontag-Bradley, an instructor in the architecture department at the University of Utah, author of Kidnapped from That Land, The Polygamous Raids on Short Creek, Arizona, co-editor of Dialogue, mother of six and grandmother of two, will briefly outline the history of the church's political involvement in regard to gender issues from the 1950s through its activities in reaction to the ERA and International Women's Year conferences. Marilyn Wierenski, author of Patriarchs and Politics, former professor of interior design at the University of Utah, freelance writer and mother of a doctor, two lawyers, and a PhD candidate in philosophy, will discuss her book and comment on its current relevance. Nadine Hansen, an attorney in private practice in California, political activist, mother of four, and new grandmother, will deal with the church's activities since the ERA, particularly focusing on the political implications of the proclamation of the family. Following their presentations, our panelists will entertain questions and respond to comments from the audience. Marty.
My job on this panel is to create a sense of historical context. And what I'd like to do is start with the beginning of the 20th century, a little bit further back than 1950, and then move up to the point of the ERA, IWY, and that's where Marilyn will take over. During the 19th century, the debate over female roles was concerned with what was called at that time the woman question. It was a grave preoccupation of families, churches, and politicians in much the same way as the economic recession and nuclear weapons would be today. Popular sensibility was dominated by an angry perplexity about why women might want to have spheres of influence outside the home. With growing numbers of women pointing out, the joys and cares of domesticity notwithstanding, there was no reason to suppose that housekeeping and intimate relationships could possibly satisfy every talent, ability, and inclination which half the human race might harbor. In the midst of such controversy, Mormon women entered the 20th century on the crest of a wave of institutional and personal power. They had joined with national feminists and the national peace movement, the drive for female suffrage, and the national agenda for reform. The Mormon Relief Society, the Young Women's Mutual Improvement Association, and the Children's Primary Association gave them opportunities for organizational power, leadership opportunities, and autonomy. Women were still performing blessings, anointings, and manifesting other spiritual gifts until the third decade of the 20th century. In other words, they were still actively engaged in spiritual as well as social work. During World War I, the LDS Church organized the Women's Relief Society into units of the Red Cross for the war effort. This alignment with national agendas typified the engagement of Relief Society sisters in social causes during the first three decades of the 20th century. And a key player in that drama was Amy Brown Lyman. Lyman first met with Church President Joseph F. Smith in March 1918 to discuss the Society's work with the Red Cross to benefit Mormon servicemen and their families. She was at the time General Secretary of the Relief Society. Lyman and a number of other women had already received professional training in the latest social service techniques, and President Smith himself was impressed, and he commented, "If there was anything in the Church that needed improvement, it was charity work, because there was much duplication and waste of effort and funds." Smith offered to fund a social service department for the church and placed it at Relief Society headquarters, physically and organizationally under female leadership. This marriage of public and religious interest created the perfect vehicle for Lyman's creative energies. Lyman first enrolled in sociology courses while her husband Richard attended the University of Chicago. There she became familiar with scientific approaches to societal problems, which she would later describe as having drawn a curtain from her mind. Under the Relief Society, the Church Social Services Department worked closely with public agencies, including the County Charity Department, the County Hospital, the City and County Courts, the County Jail, the Police Department, the Salvation Army, the Travelers Aid Society, the YWCA, and the Charity Organization Society. This cooperative relationship with government agencies continued through the Depression years and was facilitated by New Deal programs. The Federal Emergency Relief Administration required that federal funds be distributed through government agencies. This federalized the Relief Society Social Services Department for an 18-month period beginning in August 1933, while a state public welfare agency was being created. Besides normal casework, Lyman's Relief Society staff provided food, clothing, and fuel orders from government stores. These women were not stay-at-home mothers staging teas and socials. They were feminists. They devoted their lives and energy to the feminist agenda. They were involved in social welfare, prenatal health, infant mortality projects such as the Relief Society milk stations, suffrage, moral education, and pacifism. In this historical context, Mormon women were feminists because they were involved in the issues of feminism. Furthermore, they were serious about their work. It defined them. And while it certainly did not preclude them from their obligations as mothers and wives, they considered social activism a serious reason for their organizational existence. A sense of social responsibility and personal empowerment rings clear in the columns of the organization's publication, the Relief Society magazine. For example, in one piece called The Official Roundtable between Clarissa Smith Williams and Amy Brown Lyman, among others, Lyman commented, "The peace armistice has measurably halted our strenuous war activities, but the Relief Society workers will not cease their efforts and loyal labors until our government gives word that we are entirely released. We received an appeal from the National Suffrage Association to join with them in memorializing President Wilson to add at least one woman to the Peace Commission, as women and children's interests demand recognition at the hands of the men who are to settle the affairs of the world." Isn't that extraordinary? The Mormon Relief Society joined in with two of the most prominent women's organizations to form and promote the feminist agenda. These efforts in the full spectrum of social and moral progressive reform typified the work of the Relief Society during this very interesting period of female empowerment. They were recognized for their work on a national and international scale. They were social activists, empowered by a sense of spirit, of self, and corporate worth, and the institutional backing of the church. Toward the end of World War II, male leaders redefined the role of women in Mormon society and placed a new emphasis on raising families. In perhaps the single most important official move affecting the relationship of women to their church, on the 29th of July, 1946, General Relief Society President Bell Spafford received a letter from Elder Joseph Fielding Smith of the LDS Quorum of the 12 Apostles stating that it was no longer approved for sisters to wash and anoint other sisters. Instead, they were to send for the elders to come and administer to the sick and afflicted. Institutional sanction for women performing ordinances of healing was thus officially revoked. Mormon women themselves had rethought their role during the war. Women who had believed they could help save the world looked inward and focused on solving the problems of their own families instead. Like the rest of the American nation recoiling from the war, in 1949, the domestication of Mormon women was idealized even as their spiritual power eroded. The same phenomenon had occurred after the Revolutionary War with a call to Republican motherhood. In the rhetoric of those post-war decades, women played a key role. Men would fight for the British and win the war, but it was women's responsibility to inculcate American values into their children's hearts and minds. Their role was to perpetuate and transmit the values, beliefs, and behavior that marked a Republican nation. In 1949, Mormon women, with their American female counterparts, joined the post-war celebration of domesticity, and increasingly, the rhetoric of motherhood replaced the emphasis on social activism. During the LDS correlation movement of the 1970s, the church pulled the auxiliaries of the church, including their publications and lesson materials, under one umbrella. The women of the Relief Society lost in 1971 their control over money and direct access to the LDS First Presidency. All LDS women automatically became members of the Relief Society. Dues were no longer collected, and they were forbidden to have separate fundraising activities or budgets. Local wards no longer staged bazaars, bake sales, and other traditional activities that helped create and sustain female ward networks. The LDS Church made considerable efforts to draw boundaries between traditional women and feminists. Increasingly, the feminist was portrayed as the enemy of the home, of family, and traditional religious values. Nationally, the Church's fight against the Equal Rights Amendment was essentially a war against feminism. On the 13th of December, 1974, Barbara B. Smith, Relief Society General President, led the effort, taking a personal and public stance against the ERA in a speech given at the LDS Institute adjacent to the University of Utah. While acknowledging historical inequities to women and conceding the impotency of legislative remedies, she insisted that, quote, equal in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was not the same thing as identical, unquote. On 11 January 1975, an editorial in the Church News criticized the ERA as being so broad that it is inadequate, inflexible, and vague. Men and women are different, made so by a divine creator. Each has his or her role. In May 1978, the First Presidency officially launched the campaign against ERA by issuing a statement opposing extension of the ratification date, citing profound veneration of the Constitution and very deep and everlasting commitment to the preservation and strengthening of the family. Anti-ERA activity stepped up in the late 1970s, including intervention on a large scale on the part of the Relief Society in the International Women's Year conferences and in feminist Sonia Johnson's 1979 excommunication. And I think Marilyn will probably address this time period more fully, so I'm going to leave that to her. In February 1980, the Church published an anti-ERA booklet called The Church and the Proposed Equal Rights Amendment, a Moral Issue. It detailed, among other conclusions, that the ERA would endanger time-honored moral values by removing protective legislation, increasing access to abortion, legalizing homosexual marriages, making women liable for the draft, reducing a husband's legal requirement to support his wife and children, eroding the power of the state, and possibly refusing to recognize, quote, the reasonable distinctions between the sexes, unquote. Now, another issue, I think, in setting the context for the proclamation on the family is the way our church has dealt with the issue of motherhood, and so I'd like to talk just briefly about that before I turn the time over to the next speaker. Victorian America was preoccupied with the role women played as mothers and continued to romanticize it through the turn of the century. Mormon attitudes toward women and motherhood were not unique, but paralleled those of the nation at large. The Victorian image provided a detailed model for motherhood, which was adopted practically wholesale by Mormon culture and remained the primary image of motherhood during the next 30 or 40 years. As was true of Republican motherhood during the earlier time period, what some scholars have called this cult of true womanhood included the idealization of mothers' self-sacrifice, love, domesticity, and divine purity and gentleness. It is ironic that this all played out against a history of serious organizational work in feminism. The sentimentalization of motherhood was increasingly perpetuated by the male hierarchy. One Mormon male leader, Heber Iverson, in a 1923 radio address said, "The standards of motherhood during any given period of history are absolutely the controlling moral factors in the world at the time. The standards of civilization are fixed by women." David O. McKay, second counselor in the first presidency, called motherhood the noblest office or calling in the world, the greatest of all professions, and the greatest potential influence either for good or ill in human life, unquote. Showing the importance of this body of ideas, the church mobilized powerful instruments to convince girls and women that motherhood was their primary role and obligation. Mormon leaders used an interesting variety of appeals. Quote, "The women who prefer society, entertainment, luxury, even a career to motherhood are not really intelligent," one leader noted. He further warned, "Divorce is a very much more frequent thing in families where a woman has economic independence and no children than under older fashioned conditions." The accusation that women were reluctant to bear children prevented the progress of unborn spirits was particularly potent criticism as well. Even as church leaders were idealizing motherhood, Mormon women were following their Gentile sisters into employment out of the home. Alarmed, church leaders expressed disapproval of wage-earning mothers. When women began contributing to the war effort, the first presidency said in 1942, "The mother who entrusts her child to the care of others that she may do non-motherly work, whether for gold, for fame, or for civic service, should remember that a child's left to himself bringeth his mother to shame." A 1956 church news editorial called "Earning Mothers One of the Greatest Threats We Have to Stable Home Life in America," and editorialized, "The Lord has said that he will hold parents responsible if they neglect their children, and working mothers and wives might well consider what he had said on the subject. There is no economic necessity today which will justify neglect of children." These ideas were emphasized visually in church publications. For example, drawings in the Improvement Era show women working at the stoves in their homes, happily dusting tables, working in gardens in full-skirted bliss, beaming smiles on their faces. They were not portrayed at desks in offices. Rather than clients, they had children and clearly enjoyed their domestic roles. These powerful images sent potent messages to women and girls that helped perpetuate the idealization of the female role, defined more narrowly after 1950 as mother. Many women were particularly dissuaded from pursuing careers by LDS Church President Ezra Taft Benson's pivotal address, which characterized women's career objectives as selfish and degrading. "The most important work women can do is in the home," he reiterated, quoting a previous church president. In March 1990, speaking at the University of Utah at a conference called "The Women in the Workforce," Benson's counselor, Gordon B. Hinckley, added his voice. "It is my opinion that the very situation of an increasing number of mothers out of the home and in the workplace is a root cause of many of the problems of delinquency, drugs, and gangs. This is a serious burden for mothers to carry on their shoulders. I have often wondered why fathers aren't similarly judged. Many women work for the same reasons as their husbands, the physical sustenance of their children. This blanket condemnation of what they do, their contributions, denigrates their efforts and devalues who they are." Mormon leaders used to acknowledge women's equal burden. Increasingly today, however, the emphasis is on difference, not equality. For instance, in the 1920s, Joseph F. Smith, in an article called "Vision of the Redemption of the Dead" that appeared in the Relief Society magazine, said that that his belief confirms the noble standard of equality between the sexes, which has always been a feature of the church. Today, a number of consistent attitudes and policies separate men and women in the church, and it seems that each of us, who are female saints, are left adrift trying to find a new way to fit in. Thank you.
book, Patriarchs and Politics, The Plight of the Mormon Woman, was published by McGraw-Hill in 1978, the paperback in 1980. I have a little joke I make about my book, a little dark humor. The bad news, I say, is that this is a very old book. The good news is that it is still current, because nothing has changed much. For those of you who haven't read Patriarchs and Politics, let me explain that in this book, I attempted to define women's status in the Mormon culture, their paradoxical history, and the complicated social, political, and economic web that encompasses Utah life, resulting from a dominant church with an unusual structure, i.e. a hierarchy with a lay clergy in which all males hold the priesthood. In other words, institutionalized sexism. The book was, I thought, a fairly even-handed study, giving credit where due. It was not a diatribe against the Mormon Church, but it did have a feminist focus and was therefore highly controversial at the time. What prompted me to write such a book? In looking back, I think of two primary reasons. One, a personal one, is that in 1962, my husband, young children, and I returned to Salt Lake City after living in New York City for many years. And simply stated, the reentry for me was difficult, an eye-opener. While we had grown up in the LDS Church, Jim and I were not active at that time and naively thought that the LDS society would pose no problem. We were wrong. Not so much in Jim's case, because he was a practicing physician and on the faculty at the University Medical School, which is not a Mormon-dominated institution. But for me, this community, with its groupthink and conforming ways, seemed oppressive, politically as well as socially. In the 1960s, fresh from New York, I was caught up in the civil rights movement, and this was not a popular issue here at that time, at least in a widespread way. I think I lost a few friends on that score. Then, the expectations and roles for women, regularly defined by men, struck me as ludicrous. I felt as if I were in a time warp and began to view my culture, the place where I grew up, as extraordinary, if not bizarre. Of course, some of these discomforts were subtle, like a tiny rock in a shoe, and I wasn't sure if they were valid or if I was simply missing the diversity of New York. It was therefore useful for me to delve into this subject to identify these issues. Incidentally, I said very little about these personal feelings when my book came out, and I mention them now only to point out that books don't come from nowhere. The second reason for my writing this book stems from some volunteer work I was doing at the Utah State Historical Society. I wanted to clear up a point of history. As you know, in the 1970s, women's issues became a hot topic. Everybody was talking about them, including Mormon Relief Society leaders, who defensively and with great pride made such statements as, quote, Mormon women have always been equal to men. After all, they were the first in the country to exercise suffrage. This is a quote from Barbara Smith. Also, liberal Mormon women who were women's rights advocates cited this early history as well. In promoting women's rights in the 1970s, they too identified with the so-called 19th century Mormon feminists. This claim began to drive me crazy. Come on, tell the whole story, I wanted to say. For unknowingly, I suppose, these women were distorting the facts. On the face of it, how could it be that in this most patriarchal of societies, women rights leaders? In fact, they weren't. This is a kind of myth. Yes, 19th century Mormon women fought valiantly for suffrage, and yes, they developed a strong women's rights platform. But according to my Historical Society research, they were put up to this stance by the patriarchy. Their women's rights platform was all tied up with the Mormon Church defense of polygamy. And it's a funny story. First, the U.S. government, alarmed at Mormon polygamy, suggested giving Mormon women the vote so that they could free themselves from bondage. Brigham Young, to prove a point, preempted the U.S. government and passed the suffrage law at once,
knowing full well that Mormon women would support polygamy because it was their religious duty. And that's how Mormon women became the first of the country to exercise suffrage. Then, of course, the U.S. government, seeing that Mormon women didn't vote to free themselves, both outlawed polygamy and took the women's vote away. At that point, Mormon women did become active suffragists and women's rights advocates. But first and foremost, on their platform, they fought for the, quote, basic woman's right to practice the marriage style of their choice, of her choice, which, of course, was polygamy, a system that oppressed women. This is a mind-boggling bit of history, which over the years became hugely distorted, and alas, is still frequently distorted today. Some historians might disagree with me. We interpret history in different ways. And I have no emotional investment in this one way or another, but I maintain that while Mormon women of the 19th century, and this is different from the 20th that she was talking about, were strong, they were strong, amazing women, and of that there is no doubt, there weren't many feminists among them. They accepted the male leadership, were guided by males, and with a very few exceptions, were obedient to patriarchal leaders. They had no decision-making power, nor did they pursue it. They were more independent than today's women because they were allowed to be and needed to be, not because they declared themselves free from male dominance. To put it another way, I suspect if those women had been alive in the 1970s, they would have fought against the ERA with all their might because they were guided by the church leaders. In any case, this paradoxical history, along with the status of women in the culture generally, became so interesting to me that I simply couldn't resist the subject. I went around saying somebody ought to write a book, until finally I decided that I was the best person for the job. I say that because my book could have been written only by an insider-outsider at that time. An insider would have become an outsider right away, whereas an outsider wouldn't get it right because she really wouldn't have understood the subtleties of the culture. What happened to me as a result of publishing this book? I was frequently asked this question, and most often it meant, what repercussions were there from church leaders? The answer is very few, because several years prior to my book's publication, Jim and I had formally resigned from the church. So I was immune to church discipline and immune to ostracism in my ward since I had no ward. Of course, well, the church public relations issued a statement that they didn't recommend the reading of my book, and that, of course, helped sales a great deal. And I received my share of death threats and warnings. One woman telephoned me every evening for several months at 6:15 or so, saying, "You are doing the work of the devil." But for the most part, publishing in the book was positive for me. I had great support from family and friends, from progressive Mormons, and from the academic community. Sterling McMurrin read some of my chapters and endorsed them heartily. It was a rewarding experience. The time must have been right for my book because for several years it became a career for me, resulting in my accepting over 40 speaking engagements to women's groups and universities throughout Utah and the western states. Another interesting consequence... Would you hand me my water? Thank you. Another interesting consequence of the book were the many telephone calls I received from troubled Mormon women who perceived a friend in me. I became the Ann Landers of Mormondom. Well, not really, because Ann Landers gives advice, and I did not. But I did a lot of listening, and these calls confirmed for me the enormous amount of conflict among women in this society, and it exists there still. In 1988, I was asked to do a 10-year later article about my book for Network Magazine, in which I was to discuss the various changes that had taken place for women since the book was published. I suppose I could do that, I said, but I'm afraid it will be a very short article. In that article, entitled Patriarchs and Politics Revisited, I cited current statistics regarding Utah women in the workplace, the wage gap, number of women legislators, women in professions and professional schools, all well below the national average, most near the bottom of the list. In other words, in 1988, Utah women hadn't gained much in those areas. Why? There is no question that male dominance in the church carries over to male dominance in the workplace in this state. As for women's status in the church, Jerry Cahill of the Public Relations Office confirmed that there had been no major changes. However, he said, the brethren had become, quote, more sensitized to women's issues and women's contributions. And indeed, they had begun to show more recognition of women. Examples, brightly colored dresses began to appear among dark suits at LDS conferences, for leaders of women's auxiliaries and some wives were invited to sit on the stand. Also, more women opened and closed meetings with prayer, and more young women were called to go on missions. In the past, as you recall, Mormons joked about women being called on missions only if they failed to marry at the appropriate age. What else? Well, the church softened the policy on taking temple endowments, a ritual ordinarily reserved for married couples. If recommended by their bishops, single women and those married to inactive or non-Mormons were allowed to go to the temple on their own, making eternal progression, to an extent, an individual matter. This, incidentally, was truly significant for some women. In the 1980s, there came also a slight change in the patriarchy's rhetoric on working women. While careful not to sanction women working from choice, no two-career families, the brethren expressed concern for those sisters forced to the workplace. The then Gordon Hinckley, Elder Gordon Hinckley, in 1983 said, quote, his heart went out to such women. And in 1985, Elder Faust, while warning women against abandoning a full-time career of marriage and mothering, quote, the highest, holiest service to be assumed by mankind, advised that they be prepared to earn a living, quote, if that became necessary. It still strikes me as ludicrous for male church leaders to tell women what to do with their time. Even the Pope isn't that presumptuous. That pretty well summed things up. It was about as far as the patriarchy had gone in 1988, and about as far as they've progressed today, all of which amounts to allowing women a few small concessions, a few more options. And note the word allowing, the key word here, because Mormon women still have no priesthood and no policy-making power. However, on an upbeat note, and this is what I concluded in my 1988 article, there has been one truly major and positive change in the Mormon society, and that is the coming into existence and the steady growth of such groups as Sunstone Symposium and the Mormon Women's Forum. I don't know how many of you remember how repressed Mormons were a couple of decades ago. Depends on how old you are. Women I interviewed for my book were terribly nervous about speaking their minds. Who will be reading this, and how is this going to be used, they would ask. And my book, at that time, was considered extremely radical. It was as if I had set off an atomic bomb on Temple Square. You're so brave, people would say, to which I would respond, it wasn't an act of courage, it was an act of madness. Of course, if you read my book today, you would find it quite mild, I think. Not radical in the least. That's because people have finally stopped whispering. Everything is spoken out loud nowadays. Well, not everything. But compared to former times, this frankness is nothing short of astonishing, or so it seems to me. I'm aware that each year a couple of Mormons are axed as a result of becoming too cheeky here. But in the long run, this open dialogue is a great asset to the society, and whether church leaders know it or not, a great asset to the church itself. Your continued success in this community is our community's best hope. I did not address the Sonia Johnson issue here. I hope that you're not disappointed about that. I think that it was pretty well covered by the press at the time. But if we maybe in the discussion period, we can go back to that. Thank you very much.
Before I start my formal remarks, I have just a couple of comments on what has been said already regarding the comments about women, about women's roles changing, and, well, not so much women's roles changing, but the attitude and focus of women's rhetoric changing before and after World War II. Several years ago, my daughter was in a ward in Colorado where they were cleaning out the library. And one of the things they had in the library was years and years and years of bound volumes of the Relief Society magazine. And so she gathered up several years that she thought might be representative of different decades of the Relief Society magazine and kept them. And later I had a chance to look through them. And the rhetoric, the language, and the focus of the magazine pre-World War II, just like in the years just shortly before World War II, in terms of women's interest in what was going on with women in the larger society. And if you take that and compare it to the rhetoric in the magazines just after World War II and in the early 1950s, is absolutely striking. So I think, in a way, I agree with a lot of what Marilyn says about women who looked like feminists and who really weren't, because they were being directed to do what the male hierarchy of the church was telling them to do. I think that one of the things that we do in the church a lot is that we believe our own propaganda. And I think that women in the church who were involved in these feminist activities really did believe in what they were doing, even if they were being directed by men. One of the things that I hope Marilyn would comment on a little bit was the International Women's Year conference that was held here, and since I thought she probably would refer to it, and so I've referred to it in my remarks, and now I need to set the stage for what I'm going to say. What year was that? Do you remember? 1977. There were a series of meetings held in each state all around the country in connection with the International Women's Year, and my recollection is that in most states, the most women who showed up at any of these was about 2,000. And there was an agenda that had been prepared and that was discussed and voted on that included a lot of legislative changes that needed to be made to help improve the status of women in the United States and really around the world as well. And I wasn't really aware that these International Women's Year conferences were going on. But when the IWY conference came to Utah, instead of a couple thousand people, something like 10,000 women showed up at this International Women's Year conference. And the reason there were so many is because the church told them to go. And when they got there, I wasn't there, but what I've read about it was that there were even men walking around with walkie-talkies telling the women how to vote. And they voted down every single, not platform, but every single recommendation. Thank you. I hope Marty will say something about it. Every single recommendation, including things like equal pay for equal work and world peace. So, while Marilyn was contemplating writing her book, Patriarchs and Politics, and I think Marty was one of the women who was voting down world peace and equal pay for equal work, I was in California, blissfully unaware of the tempest that was blustering in Utah. But actually, I wasn't quite blissful. I was silently seething. I remember distinctly the day I first heard of the Equal Rights Amendment. I was in my bedroom, ironing, tending my kids, listening to the radio, when the network news came on and with a story that Hawaii had become the first state to ratify the ERA almost immediately after it was passed by Congress. At the time, I probably would not have called myself a feminist. Still, having been raised to believe in the Golden Rule, I knew instinctively that the ERA was only right and only fair. In the back of my mind, barely within the reaches of my consciousness, I thought, when women achieve equality in the larger society, the church will treat women better. Over the next few years, I became aware of subtle and then more blatant church opposition to the ERA, and more broadly to the women's movement in general. By the time Barbara Smith spoke out against the ERA and the Church News editorialized against it, I was well aware of what Marilyn Wierenski would later call the double dose of the double message. As church leaders' insistent voices declared over and over how exalted women were and how much the church loved and honored women, all the while it was engaged in a crusade against amending the Constitution to assure women's equality under the law. At some point in early 1978, I had a moment of epiphany. And this is, I didn't know about Marilyn. I didn't know about any other Mormon feminists at the time. I knew by then that the church prided itself in the fact that women in early Utah were the first in America to vote, and that 19th century Mormon women were involved in a wide variety of non-traditional roles. One day, I was in the library looking at a book about the history of women's suffrage in America. In a footnote, the author wrote approvingly of served the needs of the church. The voice in my head exclaimed, "So what if they gave women the vote? They already had their minds. Women's suffrage was no threat to Mormon power. It consolidated Mormon power over the Gentile minority." Now, at the time I thought that, I really had very little knowledge about Mormon history. The only Mormon history book I had read at the time was Essentials in Church History by Joseph Fielding Smith. But I just knew this instinctively. It was a watershed moment. But women talk about having a feminist click, about, you know, suddenly understanding feminism. And that was right when I started identifying myself as a feminist. At the time, I didn't know any Mormon feminists. I thought I must be the only one. I'll bet Marilyn talked to a lot of women who said something similar to her. Soon I started reading books about the ERA, and I decided that I was firmly in support of it. Several months later, I read a newspaper article about a Virginia woman named Sonia Johnson who had testified before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights and who'd gotten into a verbal sparring match with Orrin Hatch. The article said that she was the president of Mormons for ERA. I didn't know at that point that Mormons for ERA consisted of about four people. Its numbers grew as word of Sonia's testimony gained national attention. I knew I had to get in touch with this Johnson woman, but I didn't know how. So I wrote to the Salt Lake City chapter of the National Organization for Women. They not only sent me Sonia's address, but also a little pamphlet entitled Another Mormon View of the ERA. And it rehearsed this history of Mormon support for equal rights for women, at least it rehearsed the myth of Mormon support for equal rights for women, I guess is probably how Marilyn would put it. With that contact, my days of feminist isolation were over. Soon I was in touch with Mormon feminists right where I lived. Now, California had ratified the ERA early on, before there was any organized opposition to it. So where I lived, the church was never visibly involved in fighting the ERA, which meant that the church, in general, was not a political battleground, as it was in some unratified states that had not ratified the ERA. There were no anti-ERA meetings in my ward, no organized letter-writing campaigns, no busing of women to state legislatures to lobby against passage, as was done in some states, all the while maintaining the fiction that the church didn't get involved in politics. Even in California, though, anti-ERA activities took place. I assisted a couple of newspaper reporters who ferreted out a story of Mormon fundraising in California for the anti-ERA activities elsewhere. Nearly $15,000 was raised from 10 California stakes and funneled through an organization called FACT, Families Are Concerned Today, to groups and at least one candidate, to groups working against the ERA and at least one anti-ERA candidate. Of the $15,000, $6,000 came in the form of two $3,000 donations from John Carmack and his wife, Shirley. I think $3,000 was the maximum that one individual could give under this under the laws that enabled this organization to exist. The rest was raised in nine Northern California stakes from hundreds of individuals who donated from $10 to $150 each. John Carmack, of course, later became a general authority. The full extent of Mormon political involvement in defeating the ERA is difficult to assess. Certainly, the church was the dominant force in preventing ratification in Western states, Utah, Arizona, I think Nevada, and in prevailing upon the Idaho legislature to attempt to rescind its earlier ratification, a move that was not allowed by the courts. In the close states of Virginia, Illinois, and Florida, where the ERA had chance of passing, and we just needed three more states to ratify it, in those states, the church's ability to quickly mobilize large numbers of ERA opponents to lobby against the amendment likely had an important impact on the ratification process. An important factor, in my opinion, in enhancing the power of the Mormon lobby was the fact that the opposition to the ERA was covert in nature. Over and over, church members were instructed to represent themselves simply as concerned individuals and not to identify themselves as Mormons. This tactic masked the fact that this large groundswell of opposition that appeared in these states was not occurring spontaneously because constituencies had suddenly become anti-ERA overnight. This tactic has been repeated recently in California and probably in Hawaii on another matter where the church has engaged in lobbying efforts to oppose the legalization of same-sex marriage. In California, what happened was that we had a letter read in sacrament meeting earlier this year urging us to write to our legislators in the California Assembly, which is the lower house of the bicameral legislature, and to support legislation that would prevent California from recognizing same-sex marriages if they became legitimate in other states. And we were instructed to write as individual citizens, and I did write as an individual citizen. Now, I was asked also to talk about the Proclamation on the Family. So moving from the ERA to the Proclamation on the Family, I wanted to first provide a context for proclamations in general. Does anyone in this room remember the substance of any proclamation given in their lifetime other than the Proclamation on the Family? No hands. Does anyone remember hearing about a proclamation before this one? Okay, what was it about? Do you remember? Okay, we have one statement that there was a proclamation that was by Joseph F. Smith? Joseph. And his counselors. That was in the early 20th century that was a rebuttal to the idea of evolution. Are you sure it was a proclamation? Okay, all right. Somebody else had a hand. Yeah. Okay, and we have another comment that there was a proclamation about accepting the Constitution as inspired, and that was early on. Also, somebody in the back. That had made what? Oh, okay, that's a statement that there was a proclamation saying that Joseph Smith and all the prophets had taught that Negroes could not hold the priesthood. And that was in 1969, we're told. Okay. I looked proclamations up in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, and let me just give you the introductory remarks from the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. It says, in the performance of their calling as apostles, prophets, seers, revelators, and spokesmen for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles have from time to time issued formal written proclamations, declarations, letters, and various public announcements. These have been addressed sometimes to the members of the church as a type of general epistle and sometimes to the public at large. All such declarations have been solemn and sacred in nature and were issued with the intent to bring forth, build up, and regulate the affairs of the church and kingdom of God on earth. Subject matter has included instructions on doctrine, faith, and history, warnings of judgments to come, invitations to assist in the work, and statements of the church growth and progress. Only a few of the many formal declarations have been labeled proclamations. Others have been characterized as official declarations, doctrinal expositions, or epistles. Some have had the signature of the First Presidency and some of the First Presidency in the 12. and some of the 12 only. This article considers four documents, and then it lists four proclamations. And somebody told me, and I really wasn't able to confirm this or not, but somebody told me that these were the only four that were listed as proclamations, which is why I ask if some of you were sure that what you saw was a proclamation. But it doesn't, the Encyclopedia of Mormonism doesn't say that, so you very well may be correct. Anyway, the four proclamations that are explained in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism are, for the most part, rather forgettable documents. It's really not surprising that none of you remember anything about them. I don't remember them ever being quoted or cited as sources for church policy or doctrine. The first was issued on January 15, 1841. It was signed by Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, and Hiram Smith, and it praised the citizens of Illinois for their generosity of welcoming the saints into their state, congratulated the saints for their diligence in the work of the last days, and explained the importance of gathering to Zion before the Lord would, quote, take vengeance upon the ungodly, close quote, and invited all who so desired to locate themselves in Nauvoo. The second proclamation discussed in the article was issued in 1845, 4 years later, by the Quorum of the Twelve, which at the time was governing the church following the murder of Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith. It was addressed to kings and rulers and peoples of all nations. It told of the great sacrifices of the saints and their persecutions. It proclaimed the importance of the restoration and the establishment of Zion. Strongly millennialist in tone, it urged people to repent and be baptized and receive the Holy Spirit and be numbered with the house of Israel. The third proclamation discussed was issued by the First Presidency in the 12 in October of 1865, and it was promulgated to correct certain theories about the nature of God which had been published by one of the 12 without being cleared and verified by the First Presidency in the 12. It stated emphatically that no member of the church had the right to publish any doctrines as doctrines of the church without first submitting them for examination and approval of the First Presidency in the 12th. The fourth proclamation was within the lifetime of probably everybody here. It was issued on April 6, 1980, on the occasion of the sesquicentennial of the church, and read by Gordon B. Hinckley on behalf of the First Presidency in the 12th. It rehearsed basic facts about the history of the church and basic teachings and doctrines of the restoration, affirmed the sanctity of the family, pled with the people of the earth to repent, and invited the honest in heart everywhere to listen to the teachings of our missionaries. With the possible exception of the fourth proclamation, which had a historic motivation, each of these proclamations addressed a specific need or situation then current in the church. Even the fourth, issued on a specific historic occasion, emphasized then-current teachings of the Church in ways that were responsive to the prevailing emphases of the Church at the time it was issued. The proclamation on the family follows a similar pattern. Time does not permit a full rhetorical analysis of the proclamation on the family, but it is an interesting exercise to compare the family values rhetoric of the 1980s proclamation with the family values rhetoric of the 1995 proclamation. There are subtle but important differences. The 1980 proclamation affirmed that the family is a divine creation, that God will hold parents accountable to rear their children, and that, quote, the most sacred of all relationships, those family associations of husbands and wives, parents and children, quote, close quote, may be continued eternally, and that all men and women are sons and daughters of God and are accountable to Him, that through the atonement we can have the opportunity of working and growing toward perfection. The current proclamation expands on the family values notions considerably. It announces what might be considered new doctrine, that gender is an essential characteristic of individual premortal, mortal, and eternal identity and purpose. That's a quote. Eternal family connections are now described as part of the, quote, divine plan of happiness, close quote, a phrase that has become more familiar in recent years. It reiterates that God's first commandment to multiply and replenish the earth remains in force, and that, quote, God has commanded that the sacred powers of procreation are to be employed only between man and woman, lawfully wedded as husband and wife. One wonders how the powers of procreation could be employed between anything other than a man and woman, though they could conceivably be, and frequently are, employed outside of marriage. The 1995 proclamation directs husband and wife to love and care for each other and rear their children in love and righteousness warning that they will be held accountable before God for the discharge of their obligations. It reaffirms the patriarchal family, stating that fathers are to preside over their families in love and righteousness and provide for the necessities of life. Mothers, it states, are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children. In a classic example of patriarchal doublespeak, did you use that term, Marilyn, in your book? Oh, okay. I remember you. I remember the double dose of the double message, but I don't remember this one specifically. It goes on to say that, quote, fathers and mothers are obligated to help one another as equal partners. As far as I have been able to ascertain, the proclamation is heard by most Mormons as a reaffirmation of the kind of Mormon family values that are very hard to quibble with: strong, loving, eternal family ties. In my ward, when the proclamation was the subject of sacrament meeting, speakers talked about the importance of having close, loving families. No one mentioned gender in the pre-existence or homosexuality or same-sex marriage, though these seemed to me to be obvious subtexts of the proclamation. When I first read the proclamation, I immediately thought about the canonization of the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Polygamy was practiced for decades before it was made scripture, before it was submitted to the saints for a vote and canonized by common consent. This didn't occur until Congress had outlawed polygamy in Utah Territory and a court battle was brewing over religious freedom and polygamy. I can't help but think that a similar motivation lies behind the issuance of the proclamation on the family. To the extent that the proclamation talks about the importance of the family, it is nothing new. The subtext on gender, however, is a further codification of an eternal patriarchal order which was and is to come, further subordinating women from the pre-existence to the eternities. It is also a clear statement that church leaders intend to resist any further societal legitimization of homosexual relationships. Sometime in late 1994 or 1995, the church attempted to intervene in Hawaii litigation that might legitimize same-sex marriage. Intervention means that the church tried to become a party to the lawsuit. Early in 1996, Mormons in California were instructed via a letter from Lauren Dunn to write to their state legislators. Did I already talk about this here? I know I mentioned it in another session. Okay, anyway, we were instructed to write these letters. And I think at the same time, President Hinckley and Lauren Dunn visited Hawaii and urged Mormons to work there against legislation that would legitimize same-sex marriage. It comes as no surprise, of course, that the church would oppose same-sex marriage and consider it a moral issue, given its past history of covert political involvement against the Equal Rights Amendment. Its actions opposing same-sex marriage look to me very much like a repeat of the anti-ERA activities of the late 1970s and 1980s. The proclamation on the family legitimizes this activity by grounding it in an official church statement, and that is what I saw as a parallel to what happened with the 132nd section of Doctrine and Covenants, where we really made it official just before we were going to go to court over the issue. One can only guess whether societal changes in the nature of families will render the 1995 proclamation on the family, with its strong patriarchal and anti-homosexual inclination, as quaint in 100 years as the millennialist rhetoric in the proclamations of the 19th century.
We now have about half an hour for questions and comments. First of all, I'd like to, given the presentations, I'd like to give the panelists a chance to respond to each other and maybe add any additional information. No? You have to pick up the mic.
I had one comment to make about Sonia Johnson. We didn't get into that a lot, but I remember talking with her early on when she was supporting the ERA, she was really a radical supporter of ERA, to the point that she said she would give her life for the ERA. However, Sonia Johnson did not think women should have the priesthood. And I used to tease her about that and say, but you're so inconsistent. But she did not see that inconsistency. And she then the angrier she became at the church, the more she came around to this point of view. And she said, Marilyn, pretty soon I'll be as radical as you are.
When you say she came around to the point, you mean she came around to thinking that women should have
priesthood? She should have power in the church.
I was... In about 1980, I wrote an article that was published in Dialogue on Women and Priesthood, and I sent a copy of it to Sonia. And by that time, she was very approving of what I had written.
I'm one of those historians that basically disagrees with Marilyn's interpretation of 19th century Mormon women's involvement in the Suffrage Association. And I've been, over the last 3 years, writing a collective biography of four women named Zina Diantha Young and her daughter Zina Young Card, were both particularly prominent members of the suffrage movement in Utah. And my read on that is that even though it was assumed that the way I look at the way the direction that Marilyn's describing comes down from Brigham and from the other leaders of the church is it's not an absolute directive that they gave to the women before they went to the conventions. But because the women, like Zina and Diantha, had sacrificed so much to be polygamous, when they went to the national suffrage conventions, they were defending who they are, who they were. Zina Young Card goes to a national suffrage convention in 1978, and she's introduced as 1878. She went to the International Women's Year Conference. No. Yeah, in 1878. I'm sorry. I always like to study the 1870s and 1970s. Maybe it's a theme. Anyway, she was only 20 years old. And she went with Emmeline B. Wells to the National Suffrage Association meetings back in Buffalo, New York. And she was introduced as the polygamous daughter of Brigham Young. And she was disappointed by that, because what she felt was that that got in the way of her being able to talk, to engage in dialogue about women's issues besides plural marriage. But she, while she was back there, she met with George Edmonds, who was behind the Edmonds-Tucker Act. And she talked at great length with everyone about plural marriage and about a woman's role in it. But my read of Zina, both Zina's involvement in that, is that they were less interested in always defending plural marriage, but very engaged in the national dialogue about women's rights. And, you know, maybe they were just two exceptional women, and there were a lot of women who were directed more specifically by the church, male church leaders to do or to vote in a certain way. But those two women, they were polygamous. They were polygamous, and so they were defending their lifestyle. But that wasn't the only thing that drove them into involvement with the women's rights movement.
I think the question I would have about that, and obviously it's an unanswerable question, but would they still have been pro women's suffrage if Brigham Young had told them not to be?
For each decade of the 20th century, there's been like one really prominent women's rights issue. In the 70s, it was the ERA. And for other generations, it's been abortion. At the turn of the century, for the first decade of the 20th century, it was birth control. You know, the first time that medically sanctioned methods of birth control were being used. Suffrage was the key women's right issue in the 19th century. And because these women felt the same need as other women in different parts of the nation to be involved in this push for women's rights, suffrage became the issue. And I think it partly emerges from this very weird situation where they're given the suffrage without asking for it, and then they have to fight to defend it, to keep it. But I don't think for all women suffrage was the only issue. I think it was a broader based attention to the needs of women in general. Suffrage was the sort of buzzword of the day, but I think it was more than that.
As I recall, I have to put my glasses. I have all this equipment here. I started my book, though, by saying, I don't know if I can find the beginning here. You keep talking while I look. I started this book by saying, out west in Utah Territory, far from the refinement and sophistication of established Eastern society, there occurred in 1870 a gathering of women, the likes of which had not been seen anywhere in America to that time, in a, quote, great indignation mass meeting held in Salt Lake City. An army of 6,000 Mormon sisters assembled to protest the abuse of female rights in what Mormon historians have called the most remarkable women's rights demonstration of the age. I won't read my whole book to you. Exhibiting unusual political expertise for their time, these stalwart sisters of the Mormon Relief Society dispatched petitions bearing thousands of signatures to the United States Congress requesting their homestead right of freedom regarding their marriage style. Now, and then I compare that to a century later in 1977 when the women's rights movement, when they had the International Women's Meeting. This is a gathering that was clearly orchestrated by the patriarchy. Now, they did, I agree with you, they did develop quite an extensive women's rights platform that included other things besides suffrage. But I'm just suggesting that they were guided into this area because of the polygamy issue and because they were directed by the patriarchy at that time, just as they were in 1977. Which doesn't mean they weren't good women.
Another thing, though, that I think comes into play, and I like the way you introduced your remarks today by describing the situation in Utah during that time period as a very complicated web. Another thing that I think was going on is that, and I use the example of the Zionists defending who they were as an example of this. They knew what needed to be defended, and there's a point beyond which the leaders, the male leaders of the church, don't have to encourage them anymore. They become crusaders of their own, and that's also what happened in the IWY situation. You know, most of the Mormon women that I knew that went did not receive any instruction from a male leader, but they knew once the call was made what they were going there to represent and what to do. You know, that had been drilled into their heads for years. And, you know, they knew what they represented. They knew who they were. And they were defending their way of life when they voted in those booths.
When I made the comment that I think that sometimes we believe our own propaganda, I think that the women took this and made it their own. There's no question in my mind about that. And I think also that Mormon women then and now were very resourceful. And they, although I think polygamy is a horrible situation for women, I think that many of them did use it to their advantage and really made very wonderful and remarkable and successful lives for themselves.
Thomas O'Day in the Mormons said that one of the challenges that the church would have to face in the future was an educated membership, and they hadn't realized the latent consequences of that. I think that this is a case in point too, that women who may be at the direction of the patriarchy got involved in suffrage and other matters became politicized, and I think that this is something that maybe the church doesn't realize the latent consequences of encouraging women to do certain things. And I think that's
how. Any other questions? Come on up, because we're taping the session. So if you have questions, in fact, sort of come up and maybe line up here or take a chair near the front. So.
While he's coming up, I think they learned that lesson after Amy Brown Lyman and the feminists of the 1920s and 30s were so empowered, they retrenched. They learned that. They saw that. Well-educated women were pulled out of power by a different type of...
Thank you.
female leader.
The question I wanted to pose was, do you all think that there's any like connection between the proclamation on the family and the Republican Party's campaign to reassert the supremacy of the suburban family values? And I don't know whether you think they both derive from a common source, or perhaps like we're trying to ride the high of this public image of the right-wing revolution.
Well, I guess since I talked about proclamation, I'll comment. Well, there's no question that throughout America we're seeing a new emphasis on the family, and that's certainly not surprising when you look at the statistics about the breakup of the family and its consequences on children, and certainly those are very, very important societal factors right now. We've got a lot of juvenile crime and kids growing up in very unstable environments. They talked about this at the first session of Sense of the Plenary Session the other night, about the importance of having stable caregivers in families who take care of young children. And so I think that the proclamation on the family probably has something to do with just what you said, that this general societal trend toward emphasizing family values. I mean, no politician in his or her right mind today would take a stand against family values. To that extent, the proclamation is completely unremarkable, because it's a reaffirmation of what we believe in the larger society. There a number of years ago, the church did a marketing survey, and this has been talked about in other Sunstone sessions. Cindy Lefevre did a paper on it, and it was found that people didn't really care so much about being in the true church. They wanted to be in a church that supported family values, and we think we invented the family, and so we've certainly used our family values as and showcased our family values as a means to attract people to the church. So I think that's another motivation of the proclamation on the family. But those things in and of themselves are so unremarkable that I don't know why they would issue a proclamation. I mean, if there was ever a family church, it's our church. We almost don't have to say anything about families. And we don't have to say anything new about families because we already so embody traditional family values. And so when I was thinking in my mind about why did they issue this proclamation now, the only thing I can come up with is that it seems to have something to do with these gender issues that are focused on the changing women's roles, because the proclamation of the family is very strongly patriarchal, and then this whole issue of gender, which is linked in the minds of many church leaders with homosexuality, and there are the statement that do you have the proclamation? Okay. Gender is an essential characteristic of the individual pre-mortal, mortal, and eternal identity. I think Mormons have always believed in some vague sense that our spirits were the same as in the pre-existence as they are now, and that our something about us that from our very beginning to from our uncreated intelligence even and existing on through eternity is unique to us. And so I think that Mormons have always believed that we were sons and daughters of God in the pre-existence. But this is the first statement that I've ever heard where it actually came out and said that gender is an essential characteristic of our eternal makeup.
Yeah, Lori wanted me to define for you the way gender is used in this type of discourse. And now that I look at Maxine, I freeze up. I can't do this. it's part of the jargon of feminist theory, and it is not a term that is generally used. I think the fact that gender as a word appears in this document helps us to realize that this is in reaction to something very specific, a dialogue that's going on about the different roles men and women play. When we use the term sex or sex, you know, in terms of the differences between men and women, you're talking about physiological differences. But when you use the term gender, what it talks about more are roles that men and women play in particular cultures or particular societies. And so if you're in a traditional patriarchal society, then it is assumed that the role that a woman will play will be in the home, domestic, you know, and certain kinds of things are appropriate and certain kinds of things are inappropriate. The way you dress, the way you think, your attitudes, all of that, it's part of this package. It's like the appropriate package. And so what this is saying is that those roles for us are predetermined. I'm sure they use the term correctly. It's intentional that they use that, because it's not just that we, by chance, we're born as men or women, you know, with uteruses or whatever else, but that we are born also into a particular track, and that track, if we're leading the proper, if we're following the proper track, will lead us to a particular type of activity in our life.
So you don't think they just said gender because they don't want to say the word sex?
No, I don't. I believe in the power of carefully chosen words, and I think that word gender was in response to something very specific.
This ties into my question, which is, I'm wondering who the real audience of the proclamation is, because in many ways, when my Relief Society gets the proclamation, they immediately put it in a pretty frame, and the word proclamation looks really good in that kind of script. And I wonder if, and they sort of just feel generally happy about it. As you mentioned, you know, this is what we believe in families. And so to them, there's one message communicated, which is, this is a church that believes in families. We want to put it up on a frame and make it look good. And then to the more academic community, we're looking at the word gender. What does it mean? We're saying, is the church going to use this as a tool to fire somebody like Gail Houston? And right.